Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is a man who is becoming world famous, Jesse McKinley, the Albany Bureau Chief of the New York Times, who's on CNN and every other place you can possibly look. Welcome back, Jesse. How does it feel to be world famous?
Well, I don't think I'm world famous at all, but you know what? I really wanted some sleep. I would take some sleep at this point.
Okay. Well, anyway, Jesse McKinley of the New York Times. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, for the first time publicly, has now addressed sexual harassment accusations. And he says he did not intend to make anybody uncomfortable. He's really sorry. Many are calling for his resignation, including some fellow Democrats. But the governor says he's not leaving. Now, you broke the news of claims of sexual harassment by two of Governor Cuomo's former aides and a third woman who met the governor at a wedding. And that has roiled the second floor. You know, nobody knows it better, the story better than you are. So give us an update on where it's all going.
Well, as you pointed out, the governor made his first public remarks yesterday afternoon. He was contrite. He was apologetic. He said he was embarrassed. You know, in 8 years of covering Governor Cuomo, it was perhaps the most shaken I have seen him speak, you know, most shaken I've seen him in public. You know, his voice trembled. He appeared, you know, genuinely upset at the scandal that has, you know, kind of engulfed his administration. And that scandal is basically involving, at this point, three different claims of unwanted advances by the governor on three younger women, including Lindsay Bolin, who was a top economic development official from 2015 to 2018. She last week basically alleged the governor had kissed her against her wishes in his office in 2018, as well as some other allegations, including offer to play strip poker aboard a state plane and kind of some lingering touches that she felt uncomfortable with. So that was kind of the impetus for a story that I wrote on Saturday night about Charlotte Bennett, who was a 25-year-old aide who I approached after Lindsay Bolin's story came out, and after it, through various twists and turns, spoke to her, interviewed her on multiple occasions at late last week, and then published a story on Saturday outlining some fairly serious allegations by Ms. Bennett against the governor, including a series of invasive questions during a June 5th meeting with the governor where he asked if she was monogamous, asked if she slept with older men, asked if, you know, she was noted that he himself was, you know, potentially open to dating someone in their 20s, mentioned that he was lonely, mentioned that he wanted a girlfriend, etc. And that all left Ms. Bennett with the unmistakable impression that the governor was propositioning her. Now, the governor denies that, but did not deny the specifics of the conversation that we outlined in the story on Saturday. So, and then on Monday, we broke the story of Anna Ruck, who is a former Obama administration official who had a encounter with the governor at a wedding in 2019, where the governor approached her, having just met her, basically asked her if she wanted a kiss, took her face in his hands. She recoiled after being kind of uncomfortable with the situation, and he then kissed her on the cheek. And this upset Ms. Ruck, and she outlined that and was able to back up that allegation with a photograph that showed the governor cupping her face kind of moments before this kiss. So in toto, all three of those allegations have left the governor trying to explain these actions, which was the basis of his press conference yesterday, Wednesday, when he came forward and said, you know, I'm terribly sorry, basically, if these actions were misconstrued. I never touched anyone. He said that twice, although Ms. Rook might have an opinion on that, which she has not spoken out as of yet. But basically was making the case that he would not resign, that he felt very strongly that he had more work to do as governor, despite, as you pointed out, you know, a fairly substantial list of Democratic lawmakers, some of whom are longtime critics of the governor, to be sure, but nonetheless, you know, a number of Democratic lawmakers calling for him to resign.
Now, Jesse McKinley, we have the specter of the leaders of both houses of the legislature being extremely critical of the governor. Is that payback, do you think? I mean, is it because he's run roughshod over them in the past?
I don't think that's what's going on here. I think that both Carl Hasty, who runs the Assembly, and Andrea Stewart-Cousins, who's the majority leader in the Senate, are both concerned about these allegations, and certainly probably hearing it not only from their constituents in their districts, but certainly inside their conferences, people who are upset about this, both people and lawmakers, who are concerned about the governor and his alleged actions, and concerned about the impact, of course, because many things are political in Albany, concerned obviously about the impact on the party, as well as on their own prospects in 2022, when they would be running for re-election and potentially, you know, in the position of running at the same time that Andrew Cuomo might be seeking a fourth term.
Well, now, is this stuff that would make a governor resign? The things he did are not illegal, are they?
Well, sexual harassment is illegal. So the question will be, from the investigation that's going to be launched by the Attorney General's outside investigator, who is yet to be named, will be probably looking at whether or not there is a provable case for sexual harassment. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't make any determination on that. But certainly sexual harassment is illegal. And the question of whether or not this is a fireable offense, you know, is comes down to two things. It's whether or not the governor himself, or three things, actually, whether or not the governor himself feels it's a fireable offense, which he indicated yesterday he did not. Whether or not the legislative leaders feel it's a fireable offense, which they seem to be taking a wait-and-see approach to see what the Attorney General has to say. And then finally, whether or not the voters see it as a fireable offense, which I suppose would be on the ballot next year when he has indicated he still wants to seek a fourth term.
Now, Jesse McKinley, are there polls now that are showing how he's doing?
Yeah, there have been some early polls, nothing kind of sweeping and concrete. Some early polls had some you know, troubling numbers, I think, for the governor, you know, where his approval seemed to have dipped. The Emerson College poll that came out a couple of days ago asked point blank whether or not he should resign. It was basically 37% said yes, 34% said no, and about 29%, which is a big chunk, said they didn't know. So I think people are still forming opinions on this, and I think obviously the governor's remarks will probably be a part of voters' calculations on that, as will the continued fallout from this.
Now, when we speak of fallout, let's talk about the pandemic powers which the legislature gave him, and now they want to take back. Are you surprised by that?
Well, in the end, I think the legislature, you know, basically repealed the emergency powers, but left, you know, certain mechanisms in place so that the pandemic response can continue. It did not surprise me at the end of the day that the legislature, you know, did not go quite as far as they initially, you know, proposed that they were going to go. They had suggested at one point that they were going to set up like a 10-person panel to review every decision that the governor made vis-a-vis the pandemic. That idea was floated in the Senate and kind of shot down summarily in the Assembly. So the deal that they cut and was announced, I believe, on Tuesday, although I've lost track of the day, is basically kind of a scaled back version of that, whereby the legislature can certainly have more influence on executive powers and executive decisions, but it doesn't, you know, completely hamstring the governor to make calls vis-a-vis the pandemic.
Now, what about the Republicans? How are they behaving with all of this?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, the last 6-8 weeks for Governor Cuomo have been a very rough time, even before the sexual harassment allegations emerged. You know, the governor was dealing with the fallout from the nursing home situation, whereby, you know, his top aide, Melissa DeRosa, had said that, in a private meeting that was caught on tape, that basically the administration had been withholding data from state lawmakers on the scope of deaths in nursing homes. And that itself set off a firestorm. And from that moment until the time we speak right now, the Republicans have been on the warpath. You know, they have been trying to make hay out of both the nursing home issue as well as now the sexual harassment issue. They have been calling for his resignation. They've been calling for investigations. They've been calling for, you know, impeachment. You know, all of which has served to kind of animate a party that was, you know, kind of in the wilderness as of the last election. You know, 2020 was not good for the Republicans in the state of New York. They lost seats in the state Senate. They continued to be in the very small minority in the assembly. And, you know, they had defections of a lot of, or retirements rather, of a lot of kind of old guard Republicans from when they held the majority in the Senate. So, you know, it was kind of a weakened operation. I think their fundraising was hurting, et cetera. So the kind of immediate impact of this kind of double-barreled scandal that the governor is dealing with is that the Republicans have they feel more confident that they might have a shot in 2022 against him. You know, this week, Lee Zeldin, the Republican representative from Long Island, said that he wanted to run for governor. Tom Reed has indicated he, too, is interested in looking at a possible gubernatorial campaign. There have been whispers that Elise Stefanik might be considering such a move. So I think you wouldn't have kind of that kind of prominent congresspeople, you know, actively considering or maybe quietly considering a run for governor if they didn't feel that Mr. Cuomo was in a weakened position.
Now, some of them are Trumpers in blue state New York, like Zeldin and others. With that said, and, you know, I have no doubt that they would have a tough time winning. If his numbers go low enough, where's the George Pataki of the moment? A guy who nobody knows, who might step forward and be more presentable to the blue state voters in New York?
That's a fantastic question, Alan, and I don't know the answer. I mean, the parallels, however, are fascinating, right? Because Mario Cuomo, who was going for a fourth term in 1994, was defeated, as you mentioned, by George Pataki, who was a little-known mayor of Peekskill, I believe, if I'm remembering my biographical detail correct.
That's right.
And you know, there was a sense, I think, in some quarters in the 1990s that there was a little bit of Cuomo fatigue statewide. I think that, flash forward to 2021, 2022, I think that will be an argument that the Republicans make, that, you know, the governor's had three terms and it's time for someone else to, you know, do the job. Who that Republican candidate might be, I'm not so sure. But to speak just for a second on the Trump issue, I think that in the case of Mr. Zeldin or potentially Ms. Stefanik, what you would probably see is, you know, a pivot towards the center, right? Depending on whether or not they had to win a primary. But if either of those kind of pro-Trump Congress people were to, you know, get the nomination for Republican gubernatorial candidate, I think they would both make efforts to distance themselves to try to get that, you know, that mushy middle that tends to win elections. And I don't know how effective that would be, but certainly you are right that this is a Democratic state. You know, Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1. So you have to really bite into that independent vote and get a lot of those independent votes in order to win a statewide election, which the Republicans have not done for almost 20 years.
Talk to me about impeachment. There have been questions, Jesse McKinley, about whether the governor could be impeached, which some experts are saying would be difficult. What are you hearing?
I think that is, at this moment as we speak, exceedingly unlikely. You know, the bar for impeachment is steep. It kind of mirrors what you see on a federal level, where the House of Representatives has to vote for it, and then the Senate acts as the trial body, so to speak. In New York State, it is exactly the same. You know, a majority of assembly people have to vote for impeachment, and then a supermajority of senators have to convict in the state Senate. I think, you know, in talking to lawmakers right now, there's not appetite for that amongst Democrats. You know, that's just not really on the table. But, you know, this is a fairly quick-moving story, and, you know, further allegations or troubling details could shift the needle there a little bit and make that more of a possibility. But I think that at this moment, that's exceedingly unlikely.
You know, Jesse, I hate to say this, but I've been around for a long time. I've been around Albany for a long time. And some of the assemblymen and senators are known for their own, let's just put it this way, proclivities. Do they really want to go there?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I mean, the sense just on a policy, professional, political level is that right now there's just not enough votes in the assembly to get anywhere near impeachment, nor really in the state Senate. I mean, the state Senate is made up of 42 senators, Democratic senators at that point, which is the supermajority. So you'd have to basically have 22 senators, Democratic senators, say they wanted to impeach, plus the 20 Republicans to get that over the top in the Senate. And that would only be if the assembly signed off on it. So just in terms of the numbers there, I just don't think that's going to happen.
Now, Jesse, we have a budget that has to get done now in New York State. This obviously, this Cuomo, weakened Cuomo, obviously has, you know, not quite the powers of persuasion that he once had.
I think the budget process will be interesting this year for a number of reasons, not only because of the kind of political landscape that we're suddenly sitting in, but also, you know, it's going to be done remotely. You know, there won't be backroom deals. There'll be Zoom deals being cut, presumably. You know, the state's finances are still somewhat in flux, although things seem to be looking up in terms of state coffers. You know, I think that whereas we were probably talking 6 months ago about fears of very deep cuts and very deep service reductions and things like that, perhaps the election of Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer becoming majority leader is going to benefit New York greatly. I think there are going to be billions of dollars coming down from the feds to help out on everything from schools to transportation to other, you know, social services. So I think the doomsday predictions that Mr. Governor and others were floating last fall will probably not come to pass. But that being said, it will still be a tight year. Certainly we're not out of the woods yet with the pandemic, which has been, you know, just a terrible tragedy across the board.
Now, Jesse McKinley, we do know that there are Democrats in both houses of the legislature, including, I believe, the leaders, who have talked about the possibility of a tax rise, which the governor has not been all that happy with. Does this mean we're more likely to get that?
I think this is a tricky question, right? Because certainly, sure, from just a purely policy and good government standpoint, you don't want to mix political leverage, particularly leverage, if that's even the right word, you know, as a result of a political scandal. You don't want to use that. You certainly don't want to see your leaders using that as a way to negotiate, right? So hopefully they're not doing that. But certainly the sheer number of Democrats in the assembly, a supermajority, and a supermajority in the state Senate will give them more muscle in dealing with Mr. Cuomo. You know, even in his apology yesterday, Mr. Cuomo said, look, we've got work to do. We got to do a budget. We got, you know, there's a lot to do, and tried to say, okay, well, let's not talk about this right now. Let's deal with the business of the state. So that's obviously partially political, probably from his standpoint. He probably does not want to talk about sexual harassment right now very much at all, and would probably be happy to talk about the budget. So I think the next 4 weeks, when the budget needs to get done, there'll be a lot of back and forth. But certainly, just the sheer number of Democrats that are in the Assembly and Senate certainly gives them more muscle at the table.
Jesse, two Capital Region Republicans have announced legislation to create a criminal penalty for violating New York's Freedom of Information Law. Tedisco and Jordan say they are pushing the measure in response to controversy over the state's handling of information on COVID-19 deaths, and we all know that that's one of Cuomo's big problems right now. Any chance of something like that passing?
Well, I think the small issue there is that there's R's behind both those members' names. It is difficult for Republican legislation to get a hearing, let alone a passage in the state house right now because they just have so few numbers. But that being said, certainly FOIL has been vexing, I think, for reporters and public, people interested in getting good information out of the government. I think that the recent nursing home issue with their data has shown that perhaps the Cuomo administration isn't always forthcoming with data that may not reflect particularly well on their handling of, say, nursing homes. Right. So certainly, I think there's appetite probably even beyond, our informed little Albany world to maybe make FOIL more robust and certainly bring attention to the fact that at the end of the day, government is by the people and should be for the people. The data and information that is produced by state workers and state officials should be viewable by the public because at the end of the day, we are their bosses. We pay the taxes that make the government run. So I think that certainly that sort of information should be readily available to people that want to see it.
Let's talk about the census, Jesse McKinley, and the gerrymander. Obviously, the Democrats have a lot of people now. The federal courts have been involved in the past. Some of these congressional districts are going to get collapsed because we know that we'll lose one, maybe two congresspeople this time around. So what happens in terms of the way this is all shaping up? Who could be the big losers here?
Well, I think that probably Republicans are certainly worried about that here. There is some kind of water cooler political gossip chatter that perhaps the Stefanik district, the 22nd, I believe, and the Tenney district, which is Utica, that those conceivably could be altered in such a way to either include parts of heavily Democratic Albany, or that they could basically be mushed together in kind of one gigantic super district, which would span from, the St. Lawrence River down to Utica. That would potentially rob the Republicans of easy wins, certainly in Stefanik's district, where she's proven herself to be very, popular enough to get reelected pretty easily, and maybe make life more difficult for Claudia Tenney, who just barely got elected over Anthony Brindisi. So, I think that those districts are maybe in danger of being mushed together. I think there's some talk about maybe some rejiggering in Western New York, and I think maybe on Long Island you might see some changing lines. But we shall see. I think the larger point you make, of course, is that New York will almost certainly lose one seat, bringing us down to 26 and possibly two, which I think, there's, no offense to Texas and Florida, but, it's New York used to have a much more prominent congressional and delegation, and we seem to be moving in the opposite direction in recent decades.
Jesse McKinley of the New York Times, would you be surprised if Letitia James has ambitions to run for governor?
I think that is a very, very hotly debated question right now. I think she's got a resume that appeals to a lot of people. She has certainly worked with the Working Families Party in the past and thus has some kind of left-wing bona fides. She has had a pretty good track record, I think, as Attorney General thus far. I think her performance vis-a-vis the nursing homes report, which kind of started off that controversy, I think the robustness of that report surprised a bunch of people and showed kind of an independence from the executive branch, which, certainly impresses people that don't favor Mr. Cuomo. So I think that it has certainly cross a lot of people's mind that Tish James will run for governor. I don't know. I don't have any reporting in my notebook that says that is actively happening. But I think as you look at potential Democratic challengers for a primary next year, her name comes up again and again.
Now, if, of course, the governor gets out, then somebody like Tom DiNapoli, who I happen to think is the best politician in New York State, but doesn't have the sort of charisma, I think, that would propel him forward. What do you think about DiNapoli?
Well, I won't tell Tom that you said that about him, but
he won't hear
this. I think I am not an adept enough student of New York State political history to tell you whether or not a comptroller ever become governor. I don't know. I will confess ignorance on that one. It's not necessarily the type of position that screams excitement, but it is, Mr. DiNapoli has served capably in that role for years and years. Yep. And I think is pretty well liked kind of everywhere. You know, I think he was in the legislature. I think he's well liked by a lot of lawmakers. I don't know if donors are thrilled with him, but I don't know that donors are not thrilled with him either. So I don't think he's made enemies, certainly in the way that Mr. Cuomo has over his 10 years in Albany. And maybe that would work to his advantage.
So, Jesse McKinley, let me just say, congratulations. I know you deny it, but you are now an international star. You can't turn the television on without seeing you on CNN. And I know that your sleep schedule has been messed up. But remember, we are delighted every time you come on and you talk to us about what you see. After all, it is the New York Times, the best newspaper in the world. So, Jesse, thanks for doing that. And thank you for keeping us on top of all of this. We look forward to having you again.
Thanks, Alan, so much.
Support comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.